Hello, welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined, always, usual, by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is going fantastic. And, listener, your day just got a lot better, because you're going to get an accounting lesson. Yay! By that, I mean the annual USA Today list of finances in college sports came out. And we're going to talk about it, because really, it's July. We're almost 60 days. Well, less than 60, but still a long way out from football starting. So we're going to fill some time by talking about money.
Yeah, well, what better way to fill your summer days on this holiday week?
Yeah, and the most interesting thing about this is always the big spenders, but 5 years ago, there were maybe four schools that spent or brought in revenues north of $100 million. Max. There weren't that many. This 2017 list, there's 28 of them.
With number 29 dug missing by like $1 million.
Yeah, so the money, it's not shrinking. I know that's a shocking revelation for many folks, but yeah, it keeps growing. Year over year, it just does not seem to stop.
One could probably guess all of those 28 schools are all in power conferences. The highest non-power conference team is Connecticut, who's 46th, which is not very high.
Yeah, and they bring in a paltry $80 million a year. I mean, that's tragic stuff. And there was even an article published in the Courant earlier this week talking about how now that the old Big East money that was being distributed to Connecticut, UC, and South Florida, and I think that's it, in compensation for having the table yanked out from under their feet, you know, that money's running out. This is the last year where those three schools will be getting a slice of that buyout pie. And yeah, I mean, like, these schools have dilemmas, you know, that they have decisions to make. And the tone of the article was about how much UConn was struggling with this. And UConn has a benefit that almost no other schools in the country have. They have a third revenue sport because UConn basketball, both men's and women's, rakes in a ton of dough. Most schools only have two. And even in that condition, there's talk of them struggling and having to make decisions.
The article is pretty interesting because, like, for as big as basketball is on both sides, like, football is still the number one revenue source for pretty much everybody. And part of UConn's problem was, like, their decline in attendance, which I'm sure if somebody on Cincinnati.com wrote an article about the Bearcats' finances, they would have the same thing with how much they just got hammered at the end of last year, especially with, I know the season tickets have bounced back somewhat since they hired Fickell. Like, the declining attendance last year was a major issue, especially going forward. But the Big East money ending, Cincinnati loses like $9.5 million of revenue. I think you're just stuck with whatever they get for the Bearcats radio network, whatever they get for any of their regional games that air, which I don't think is anything. I don't think. I could be wrong about that. I don't know what their deal with FS Ohio is. But, like, yeah, that's pretty much your two big
It's not tremendously lucrative, but they, yeah, the FS Ohio deal is not tremendously lucrative, but, and it really only covers the non-conference schedule at the beginning of the year, but it is something, you know? And when you're at this level, every little bit counts. And like, I think this is really the argument for why UC has put as much into capital assets as they have, because Nippert Stadium is, you know, it changes the financial model. I've said that phrase I don't know how many times. Many. I'm gonna go with many. I'm not even gonna hazard a guess. Just a lot. And it really does, because you no longer are dependent on simple, you know, ticket sales for being the biggest source of your revenue. And this was, you know, in 2016, the year ending 2016, this was the most money that they had made from ticket revenue ever. And that was with a program that was basically in revolt at the end of the Tuberville era, with thousands of people going through on their longtime threat to cancel their season tickets because of their disagreement with how the program was run under Tuberville. Some of those people have come back with Fickell, and I think the ticket sales and the contributions will go up considerably next year, or this coming year, and then the year after that when the arena opens. Both of those numbers are going to get a boost, but it's still, you know, it's still not where you want it to be.
Yeah, because for both sports, you're kind of stuck with non-conference games that really don't have any steam behind them. Like, the basketball, the average attendance gets killed because nobody goes to games in November and December. And, like, the football schedule, like, at least home, like, is really nothing to write home about for the next few years. Like, the biggest opponent they play until, like, 2022 is they play UCLA in a couple of years, and they play Indiana in 2022. Like, not exactly lining them up for the foreseeable future. Which is something that was interesting in the current article. That's how UConn is starting to take money games. Like, they just got a game against Clemson. Like, you wouldn't think that, like, a program like UConn, just because of where it is, like, what its league is, would have to take a money game. But they do. And it's probably something that Cincinnati is going to have to start considering here in the future, if they don't get the boost that the AAC wants in its next media deal.
Yeah, and we'll circle back to the media deal and what that means, and the whole Power Six argument that they're trying to make. But you're absolutely right. Like, it's getting to the point where, you know, UC, if offered $2 million for a buy game, they have to take it. No question. You know, they can't turn down that kind of money. I mean, that is how Ohio State bought the game. I mean, that was essentially a buy game, if you think about it. You know, Ohio State bought that Cincinnati game from where it was going to be played at Paul Brown Stadium and brought it to Columbus. They bought that. And what UC did with that money was they paid for the Shakely Lawn or the Shakely Athletic Complex. And that's something that they had to do. But there's no, you know, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about the fact that Ohio State purchased that lovely practice facility for them.
Yeah, definitely. People said that type of stuff when it happened a few years ago. Like, there's a lot of people upset that Ohio State wasn't coming back to Cincinnati. And the next time they play is, what, 2019? 2019 schedule already done, which is pretty nice. But that's something that these smaller, like, as the divide grows bigger and bigger, like, it's something that the AAC is really going to have to struggle with for football, is you're going to have somebody be really good and raise the prestige of the conference that way, and you're just going to have to find some type of money game with probably a national powerhouse, which was the case with UConn, and it's probably the case with UC every time they play Ohio State. So I'm pretty sure they'll never play at Nippert, and they'd have to play them at Paul Brown Stadium, even if Ohio State even wanted to do that again.
True. I mean, like, that's just, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. The powers that be at Ohio State, they have all the leverage, and they're never going to let that situation come to be. I'm sure that whoever agreed to the deal in the first place that even scheduled a game in Cincinnati got fired. You know, like, there's so much momentum to let that not happen in Columbus that it's just never going to happen. But the really interesting thing about looking at this list is you can, like, you can see in black and white exactly where the divide is in terms of college athletics and resources. All right. So if you pull up the list from USA Today, you know, you look at the top and you're amazed by Texas A&M having $200 million, essentially. It's like, but you need to scroll down to see this, right? So between 52 and 53, you know, those are ranks in order. But there is a essentially $14 million gap between Oregon State and Central Florida. That's the divide. Because on either side of that, there's only one program from below, above. That's UConn. And there's only one program from the Power Five that's below that. And that's Washington State. And, I mean, like, you just can't see it any clearer than that. That's it. That's where this divide is. That's where it's always going to be. And it's never really going to change. So you can make the argument that the AAC should be the sixth power conference, blah, 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 blah. And on the field, and in, you know, in terms of how these things are measured with draft picks, et cetera, et cetera, yeah, you can make the argument. You're probably not going to win it, but you have enough facts in your corner that you can make this argument, right? But, I mean, the real argument is that the AAC as a whole spends more than the rest of the Mountain West, which is the conference below them in the pecking order and has been for years, right? So there's a gap between them, but there's also a huge gap between the AAC and the Power Five. It's at the point where the AAC is essentially a thing unto themselves, because they have all these schools who spend way more than the rest of the Power Five or the Group of Five counterparts, but not enough to be in the Power Five. And they really don't have any peers but themselves.
Yeah, definitely, because you're not going to get any pushback from, like, the MAC or whatever else league there happens to be. It's pretty much them and the Mountain West. And the Mountain West is buoyed by the exact schools you would think it would be buoyed by, like your Boise States and your San Diego States and so on. But then, like, it's kind of an interesting, like, discussion, because the top of the AAC, like, obviously, like, the Florida schools and Cincinnati and UConn bring in a lot of money. Like, the, like, bottom half of the league doesn't do, like, too terribly. But there's still, like, a gigantic gulf between where they are top to bottom, and even, like, the Big 12 is the probably worst power conference league, and they still, like, their TV deal with, like, $300 million or whatever. Some crazy amount of money. It, like, dwarfs the AAC. So it's a... it's one of those things that, like, really catches up to you. And this, like, next TV deal is huge. It's like, look what just happened to Conference USA with their terrible deal. Like, they're never on TV anywhere. And, like, none of their programs really make any type of money.
Yeah, and don't forget about the MAC and their latest deal. Like, this coming season, there will not be MAC football on Saturdays. And this is not hyperbole. Like, there will not be a football game on Saturdays in that league. Everything will be Monday through Friday. Every game.
Yeah, from what, like, the last, like, two months conference play starts.
Well, especially in November is when it really ramps up. But even, like, in conference play, they start the Tuesday and Wednesday games, which usually aren't really till late October. I think they're starting even earlier this year. But they are, I mean, like, you got to hand it to them. Like, this is the only time they're going to get exposure. They have to lean into this, and they're going to. But I kind of admire it. I think it's a terrible idea, but I kind of admire the gumption. But like, if you are in the position where the AAC is in, you're kind of stuck because you can't lean into that model the way that the MAC can, because there's too much to lose. You know, coaches hate midweek games because these are creatures of routine, right? These guys wake up at 5 o'clock every day, go to the gym, and then go to the office, and they're in the office by 6:30 every day. Like, that is the schedule of every coach on earth in this sport, right? That's how they operate. But you can't really do that if you don't know when your game is that week. So it just kind of throws everything into flux. And you know, let's call it what it was. Yeah, last year, the midweek games for the MAC pretty much sucked. Like, there was no Northern Illinois Toledo 4 overtime game to remember this year. They were, for the most part, a bore. And that's the last thing that you want. So, like, the AAC is clearly differentiated from the rest of the group of five. But they're also not in the position where they can make a plausible argument that they are part of the Power Six. Because there's just such a gap between them and the rest. In both directions.
And these numbers don't even have the private school information. So we don't really know how some of the bottom feeders in the conference are doing. Like, East Carolina, looks like they put in $44 million in revenue. So, man, like, you go further down the list, it's probably not very pretty.
You don't see Tulane there. That's not because they don't exist. It's because they're a private school, right? Mm-hmm. But they'd be down there probably in the hundreds.
Yeah, definitely. Just because of, like, where they are and, like, the exposure that they get, or lack thereof. Like, the AAC is in a really interesting position because they're going to have to start playing. Like, they already play, like, some Thursday and Friday games. But I'm going to bet that there's going to be a lot more coming soon. Unless, like, ESPN decides, hey, we'll put your games on TV since we lost the Big Ten, which they aren't doing this year.
But the problem with that, the Big East was the first conference to really, really embrace, you know, the weeknight game as a concept, right? You know, the best, most memorable game in the conference's history, it's UC Pitt. But the second most is Louisville and West Virginia in 2007. Like, that's the model. And that was, you know, that was the platonic ideal of what you do, why you play on a Thursday. Right. So they did this, and they had that market to themselves, well, them and the ACC, for, let's call it a decade, right? And then everybody else started paying attention, and they're like, you know what's a really good idea? Play them on Thursday nights. And they immediately, it's like the Big East was the last attractive girl at the bar to ESPN. So they got into bed, and they were happy with it, and everybody was cool with the arrangement because they knew it was of convenience, right? But then all of a sudden, 2009, 2010, 2011, another pretty girl was somehow at the bar at 1 o'clock. And ESPN just did the stiff arm, straight Heisman'd it out, and started working with the Big 12 and the Pac-12. Because those two conferences saw that this was a good idea, and let's lean into it.
Yeah, and like, now you have like the Big Ten even like branching out into weeknight games, at least Friday night games, with their new deal with Fox. It's like, even that particular state is going to be a little harder to navigate.
See, the problem with that is, like, Fox thinks they're buying, you know, the prime package. And they will get the Ohio State-Michigan game, which is the most valuable property that a conference can offer to any of these networks. But Ohio State and Michigan and Penn State, to a lesser extent, they have the sway and they know it. So you're not going to see much Ohio State or Michigan in those Friday night slots unless they're playing, I don't know, Rutgers or Maryland.
So we already know
one of the other programs that doesn't matter.
Yes, we already know that none of those teams are playing home games on Friday night or Thursday night, whenever they do it. If they're on that, they're because they're on the road. I'm pretty sure Ohio State opens the year at Indiana on like a weeknight.
Yeah, but they've done – Ohio State has done Thursday night games before to open the season. So that's not new. I think they did it against Marshall. It might have been 4 or 5 years ago. But they – that's something that's happened before. But that's the only scenario where they will allow it to happen, especially at home. Once the season starts, it's Saturdays only for them.
Yeah, so like that really does leave that AAC in kind of a weird position. It's like you want to get yourself the most exposure. It's like we know, pretty much we know without a doubt, any weeknight game is going to probably be on ESPN or a ESPN channel. And any weekend game is on CBS Sports Network because of that deal. It's like you're kind of stuck in a weird limbo where you have to try to get on TV somehow, some way, in this crazy landscape where they're trying to make football on every single day for some reason.
Yeah, and I think really the only option they have at this point is to lean hard into doing starting conference play in September, which they already do, but trying to have two or three of the biggest, most anticipated games of the conference season take place in September. When everyone else, when every other conference is still ramping up to the regular season, the answer for this conference is to schedule their conference slate to start, which they've been doing since the inception of the league, really, and to make sure that they have marquee games in the earlier part of the season where they can grab the biggest share of eyeballs.
It's for the most part, like, well, we can just look back to the last 2 years. We have a clear example. Like, when Houston was good, like, their games would end up on, like, the ESPN or the ABC game, like, late in the season when they were competing. And then last season, like, nobody gave a shit about the AAC, and none of the games ended up on ESPN. And, like, people just forgot the league existed until the championship game. And like, oh, there's the championship game in the AAC now?
That snuck up on us.
Oh, look at Navy and Temple. Oh, man.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is just taking stock of what intrinsically in our hearts all Bearcat fans already know, which is going from the Big East to – going from Conference USA to the Big East was great. It was a step up. But even though the name of the league changed, it's still the same spot. Nothing's really changed. Right, in terms of revenue, UC's 54th. It probably been 54th, you know, in that 50 to 60 range for the last, I don't know, 15 years. And if you add in the private schools who don't have to take part in this because they can just flat out say, fuck you, we're not exposing your records. Like, Notre Dame would be number one in terms of revenues. I would be shocked if their total revenue is under $200 million. Just shocked. But they don't have to take part because they're a private institution.
They just got to think their numbers would be outrageous. Like Texas A&M's number one at nearly $200 million. You got to think Notre Dame would have them beat. Just based off the NBC deal alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And the NBC deal is probably a deal that NBC wants to remake, but it's never going to happen because it's just too lucrative for Notre Dame to even come to the table.
Yes. There's no reason for them to do it.
And, it's like one- and there is one other interesting... The most interesting thing to about this outside of the UC stuff for me is looking at Oregon, because we have now pretty conclusive proof of how much making the national championship game in the playoff is worth, right? So if you look at their revenues, it goes up, 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 up. And between 2013 and 2014, they made a jump of $80 million in revenue. And the last 2 years when their football team sucked, and even though their basketball team was great this year, their revenues are less than they were in 2013. Like they went up $80 million when they made the playoff and made the national championship game, and then they went right back down by almost exactly the same amount. That's fascinating to me.
It just really does go to show how much of this stuff like actually pays. Like once you hit the big time. Like I'm pretty sure if you looked at Florida State, Florida State's is pretty even. Probably because they share with the league. It has to be something like that.
Yeah, and I would love to see what the explanation for that $80 million jump is, but that's the timing's a little. It's perfect, you know. It's like, well, how did that happen? But Clemson had a big jump as well this year. They went up almost $21 million in revenue. But the problem for Clemson is their basketball team sucks. Forever.
And then they'll get the same revenue boost from making the title game again. So really it all shines up real nice for Clemson. And like all the big ACC like power hitters are like almost all in the top 30.
Yeah, I mean, the ACC is clearly the third in the pecking order. I mean, like, Virginia. How is Virginia have $100 million in revenue? Lacrosse is not that popular.
Well, it looks like they get $40 million from rights and licensing fees. Their jump from 2008, they had $15.6 million in rights and licensing fees. To 2016, it's $39.6 million. It's quite a lot.
That's noticeable.
Even for like a comparable program to Cincinnati like Louisville, like they went from 2013, they were in the AAC or something, weren't they? Like, we're at $96 million to $112 million just by joining the ACC. And, like, their rights went from $23 million in the last year of the AAC to $38 million in the ACC. It's a pretty gigantic jump up after their year to get acclimated.
Yeah. I still hate all these secondary schools in the Big 12 for deciding that their ability to recruit Houston is far more important than our ability to survive and eat. Fuck you, Oklahoma State.
Just taking a look at Cincinnati's, like, there's like the clear jump in like the rights fees from like 2005 to even like 2009. It went up like $12 million. Then it pretty much has stayed almost the same between then. So like this, like the losing this Big East money is gonna really hurt. It's like, as you mentioned, UC's been right around the same in revenue since they've been in the Big East. With like a jump like the last 4 years, probably because of all the buyout money.
Yeah. And We know how much a Sweet 16 run is worth, because there's a $5 million jump from 2012 to 2013. That's not entirely from making the Sweet 16, but your share goes up enormously with each win. Which is yet another reason why this team needs to make a fucking second weekend again, soon.
it's every, pretty much every school on here has gigantic stadiums. Like the top 10, Texas A&M, Texas, Ohio State, Alabama, Michigan, Oklahoma, LSU, Florida, Tennessee, Auburn. Like all 100,000 seat stadiums, all sell out every game, all in like major leagues with gigantic TV deals. And all of them do relatively well every year in both sports. It's like there's a gigantic like advantage just for that.
Yeah, and the Texas A&M one is the most interesting to me because there is a, let's call it $60 million jump between 2014 and 2015. And what happened at Texas A&M between 2014 and 2015? They built a massive new stadium that has essentially five times as many luxury suites as they used to, and they sold out every single one of them. So yeah, their contributions from alumni and other such folks tripled by building a massive, massive new stadium.
Yeah, and that's just an area where, like, I think that's the biggest gulf between the Power Five and the rest, is you really don't have any of those types of things. Like, it just doesn't add up. 2016 Cincinnati contributions, $4.6 million. So, gigantic difference of $90 million. Or whatever insane number it was. That's just crazy.
Yeah. But even that,
it was
like...
$70 million. So, so close.
So close. But still, like, the contributions have gone up immensely over the last few years for UC, and that has all to do with the new stadium. And you could argue that the new stadium is why they had to move on Tuberville is, you know, it, this year more than anything. Because like, they saw such a precipitous drop-off in contributions in people buying seat licenses for the new tower in this last year that they just couldn't stomach it again. They just had to get rid of that. They just had to do something else.
Exactly. It's like the ticket revenue is another giant difference, which everybody knows how big a difference it is. Cincinnati like made $7 million off their ticket revenues. And, I don't know, just pick a school at random. Like Washington made $25 million. It's like just having a bigger stadium in both sports, really, like, really helps those schools out. And you're kind of stuck with Nippert. It's like, nobody wants to change Nippert. But you need sellouts every week. You need 45,000 in the stadium every week. And whatever, however many they can fill into the new basketball arena.
Yeah, and this next year is obviously a transition period because they're not playing any home games and they're going to have to pay rent, which is, it'll be interesting to see what happens next July when this essentially giant-ass spreadsheet drops again. But we'll revisit that then.
It would be interesting to see how much ticket sales changed with the Paul Brown Stadium season.
They went over $8 million both years.
And so even then, like, there's a certain advantage to even just having those random home games in Paul Brown Stadium, which outdrew Nippert at the time. But at the same like flip of the coin, you don't have West Virginia and like Louisville fans coming in to help sell out a bigger stadium, or not sell out, but put asses in seats at bigger stadiums.
Very true.
I don't think it's going to get 50,000 for SMU.
I don't know. Those are some rich cowboys.
I don't think SMU like drew 50,000 between like three of their games last year.
Yes, that's why you add. You don't average. All right, so I think we have successfully talked the accounting portion of this evening's program off the edge of the cliff, as per usual.
Yeah, so there's a lot to look forward to and being depressed about the football contract coming up.
Yay! Also, we can be depressed about our first arrest of the Luke Fickell era, so that's fun. Cornerback Alex Thomas, the starter on last year's team, decided to commit a little aggravated robbery. So, not great.
He's already been suspended, which, obviously. And I guess to his credit, he didn't have a weapon with him. But he was part of an alleged robbery attempt, which I guess he admitted to, so it's not really alleged that much, is it? How does crime work?
Technically, it's alleged until it is proven in a court of law. I mean, not that he's going to sue us for libel, because between the two of us, like, he can successfully sue for... I mean, I don't know what you guys got. I got, like, three nickels and this mouse that I'm using to control my computer.
I have my mouse and my headset, so... So he can really take a lot from us.
Oh, and I do have a microphone. So I guess, you know, he can shut us down if he wanted to. But I'm not really sure how libel works. Yeah, how that law works. But anyways, he did something stupid. He got caught. He's kicked off the team. And that's probably the last we will see of him.
It's not libel if we're reading his quotes. Like, you can't say, oh, that was bad when he said it to the police or whoever interviewed him. But yeah, he was one of the best players in the secondary last year, so that's going to be a pretty big blow. He had 4 interceptions. He shined at various parts of the season. I know some people out there saying, did the secondary really shine at all last year? And, like, not really. But they had some nice games, like Purdue. They'll always have Purdue.
Purdue got Michael, you know, he got Iron Mike a spot in the NFL. So we'll always have Purdue. It's really all we had last year was Purdue. It's pretty much straight downhill after Purdue.
But hey, it beat a Big Ten team on the road. How many other teams in the league did that last year? Like, nobody.
None. Probably. None is correct.
Tulsa definitely didn't do it.
UCF did not.
Yeah, UCF didn't come within like 40 of doing that. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, like, it's a loss for the team, but this is what happens. Fickell handled it the way you should. You know, no complaints there. Everybody's just gonna move on, and we'll see what happens. I mean, this is the time of year where kids go home and do stupid shit, though. You don't necessarily have to go home and do stupid shit. You can do stupid shit wherever you're at.
I think that's the main lesson we learned here, is, like, you can stay in Cincinnati and do dumb things just as easily as going home in the summer and doing dumb things. It works.
True that.
I think the weirdest part about this whole instance, that it took place at 2:30 in the afternoon. It just seems like the wrong time of day for an alleged robbery attempt.
Yeah. I'm no master criminal, but I'm pretty sure daylight is generally not conducive to criminal activities.
Especially in the any place that has cameras. Also, a bad place to allegedly try to rob someone of their marijuana.
We live in fascinating times.
That's like, I don't know. But we talked about this a bit before we started recording. But really, like, he's on the football team. Like, unless his friend is, then it's nefarious. I'll say that. He can probably get his own weed, like, from someone for free. Like, oh, hey man, here's some weed. Problem solved. So, like, let's go about our day. No need for robbery, kids.
Yeah, it's been 7 years since I graduated college. But it was pretty easy to get weed in Cincinnati in 2010. I don't think it's gotten harder. Not that I smoked or have smoked at any point in my life. I'm just saying it wasn't that hard. It's probably easier now because, you know, you can Snapchat somebody and be like, can I get a blunt? And it goes away.
Death, it really doesn't say much about that whole situation. You would have to resort to robbery. Just, okay, we're all thinking the same thing of what his friend was up to. So we can probably move on to sunnier topics. And hopefully things work out well for Alex Thomas, wherever he ends up. If he ends up back at UC or if he ends up at some like JUCO this season, hopefully he hangs out with people who don't try to rob people for marijuana.
Let's hope that. In less depressing football news, LBJ, not that LBJ, the one on UC's team, is all kinds of freaky, according to Bruce Feldman. So our JUCO that Tommy Tuberville unearthed somewhere that no one else had heard of before, turns out he's kind of a freak. Because Bruce Feldman has released his annual freaks list, and he made the list. Not Mike Boone, who's all kinds of freaky, but Lyndon Baines Johnson. Why did he do that? Because he's 6'3", 300 pounds, with 4% body fat.
It's 14% body fat. Which is pretty incredible if you're 300 pounds and 6'6". With an 86-inch wingspan, and he bench presses 415 pounds. Like, normally, if people have that long of arms, they don't bench, like, nearly that much, just because, you know, how arms work.
See, Durant Kevin, who has never benched 185 pounds in his life.
Yeah, it's like, that's...
True fact.
Like, that's pretty impressive. And, like, hopefully... Like, sounds like a combine warrior. Like, hopefully that plays out for him on the gridiron this year. It is good to see a player on UC get some more publicity, other than Mike Boone, who seems to be like the top guy people talk about when they talk about the Bearcats.
Yeah, and there was a really interesting article from ESPN a couple weeks ago about the Bearcats strength and training program for basketball. And, you know, it's rapidly become the case where the most important person in your coaching staff, other than your head coach, is your strength and conditioning strength and conditioning guy, whether that's basketball or football. Because those guys have the most interaction with the athletes, and they have the most hands-on coaching time of anybody, because they're with them all year round. The head coach, the assistants, they can be there sporadically, but usually it's only in season and during spring football where they have hands-on contacts for the, you know, NCAA allotted 20 hours of practice time a week. But there's, you know, for the most of the year, that 20 hours a week is all strength and conditioning.
It's like it's so many like others, like especially basketball, you hear so often about how players like change their bodies. Like you could probably just look at every Cincinnati basketball players rolled down the line the last few years. It's like a lot of them have like changed their bodies and they're in pretty excellent shape for basketball players.
Yeah, it's I can't wait to see what Jerron Cumberland looks like next year. Because he already looked like a linebacker. I mean, he can't get any bigger. He can't look like a defensive tackle next year. Or maybe he can. I don't know.
Would you really want him to, though?
No.
Like, you look at Gary Clark and just, like, how he's, like, matured for his, like, three seasons. He's, like, a lot bigger, a lot, like, more athletic than even he was when he started his UC playing career. Like, even, like, Troy Copain, look how much he changed from when he was a skinny little freshman until he was a linebacker himself, or at least a free safety by the end of his career.
Yeah, and there is a lot of question about, like, where the money for coaching staffs goes. And, you know, I get it, but these programs invest so much in the back end of, in terms of strength and conditioning coaches, nutrition, all this kind of stuff. And that stuff adds up, and that is expensive, but it's definitely worth it because it has a huge effect on the field, on the court.
And if you're going to, like, find one video of a coach going crazy, it's always the strength coach. They're always the most interesting coaches because they're all, like, crazy motivational people who are, like, batshit.
They're all Tony Robbins.
Except they yell a lot and their faces get really red.
Tony Robbins.
So we should talk too about Troy Copain. He did end up on the NBA Summer League roster. Don't know if he's playing in this current Summer League or the next one. There's too many Summer Leagues.
I think the Raptors are only take place in the Orlando one, which is, I think, later. It's usually later in July. But I could be wrong on that. I know it's been that way in the past, but that doesn't mean that's how it is now. As you can tell, we did a lot of research for this. We did not just kind of throw this together. Not at all.
At least we knew that he was on the Summer League. We knew that much with the Raptors. We got that part right.
Yeah, we nailed the basics like a split hog.
He's in the Vegas Summer League, so that starts today when this podcast is posted. So you can maybe watch him play?
NBA TV.
But hopefully he'll end up getting some run with the Raptors D-League team. Not D-League team, but Summer League team.
If he does well with the Summer League team, he might get to the D-League team. And if that doesn't work out, he can always go to Europe and make six figures.
Or even, like, just end up there, like, going for it anyway. And the G League, it's now called.
It did work for SK. Just saying.
It's not such a bad way to go, like, nowadays. Especially with how much they seem to be really pushing for that to become a major developmental league.
And the fact that they've allocated, I think it's two or three roster spots that are basically flex spots where you can send guys back and forth between the regular team and the D-League. You know, and they make a D-League salary when they're with the D-League affiliate, but they make an NBA minimum salary when they're with the NBA team. And that's for, you know, like, for a developmental prospect, that's kind of perfect. Because there are going to be times where they're short on bodies just because of how the NBA works and the way the schedule is condensed, where they're going to need guys. It'll be interesting to see how that gets managed in the coming years, because that was a big part of the new CBA.
There's Edwin Sumner, the guy from Xavier, he just signed one of those two-way deals. So it'd be pretty interesting to see if, like, Copain can, like, break out on the roster. Even if he doesn't, if he can just, like, find himself a way to keep playing professionally. Hopefully in the NBA, but I'm sure he'll do well for himself.
Yep.
He is listed as a shooting guard on the Oreo GM site, which I think is kind of interesting.
I mean, are we really going to have the is Troy a point guard, like an actual point guard discussion now? Because, I mean, we can have it. It's kind of late, but we can do this. Because really, he's more of a combo guard than anything else.
Oh, it should be interesting to see him play. They have Fred Van Vliet, it's their lead guard, probably. So he'll probably get some run, but probably not too much. They don't want to, like, wear out their NBA players. Will Sheehy is on their team, which I didn't know. He was actually on the NBA roster. That good luck guy is who I remember was a UC target. He ended up going to UNLV, and he turned pro at some point. Seems kind of crazy. Why did he go pro? He doesn't seem very good.
There are dozens and dozens of people who go pro every year who should not. That's why.
He did go to UNLV, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I remember last year when Mick Cronin was talked about going to UNLV. It's probably good for him he didn't go. Except now, like, they have like a top like 10 recruiting class. So maybe it's bad for him he didn't go. We'll never know. That was a stupid point to bring up out of nowhere. If I just changed
it. Yeah, I think that's the point where we say, bye y'all!